Come to order. Welcome. We have several bills today of great interest, and I'm sure that you will all enjoy the discussion that takes place. Okay, first bill that we're going to hear is Senate Bill 40, and I will open a... Do you want to talk about Senate Bill 40?
Our Senate Bill 30 allows licensed hearing aid specialists to certify individuals as eligible to receive assistance telecommunication devices or adaptive equipment through the Telecommunication Devices Access Program.
Okay. So I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill...
Work session,
because we've already done that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 40 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 40 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing no discussion, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Mondes Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morrison?
Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 40 passes to the floor. Do we have a volunteer for Carrier? Senator Cruz, today with a smile like that, you will be successful, I'm sure, in everything you do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We will now take a look at Senate Bill 200. Do you want to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 200 increases the maximum amount of civil penalty that may be assessed by the State Board of Pharmacy.
Okay. We will open up public hearing on 200. And the witnesses, do we have testimony? Anyone wishing? Oh, we have a sheet. Okay. Okay, Gary Schnabel, would you come up, please? And Gary Miner. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Schnabel. I'm Executive Director for the State Board of Pharmacy, and I'm joined today by Gary Miner, who is the Compliance Director for the State Board. I will do the presentation,
okay.
and Gary is here to answer questions since he's in the compliance side and has all the background on this that I may not have. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm prepared to just give you a quick summary of what the bill does and why we decided to do this term, and then answer any questions that you might have, unless you have a different way that you want to go. Senate Bill 200 has four sections. It's a pretty short bill, and we are looking at it as more of a housekeeping kind of bill. Section 1 amends ORS 689-475 to increase the maximum civil penalty that the board can issue against a licensee from $1,000 to $5,000. And it also would allow the board to assess the cost of disciplinary process against the person being disciplined. Section 2 of the bill amends 689-475 to increase the maximum civil penalty that the board can issue against any person who violates that chapter from $1,000 to $5,000. The board in different sections has the authority to discipline a licensee or to discipline a person who violates that Pharmacy Practice Act. Section 3 simply adds the following section number 4 to Chapter 689, and that provides the board with authority for ongoing jurisdiction to proceed with an investigation or action or disciplinary proceeding against a licensee who lapses or surrenders the license in an attempt to avoid disciplinary action. The reason this comes up at this time, the board has talked about this and thought about it for a number of years, but our compliance staff performed a series of investigations into pharmaceutical wholesalers last year, and all three of these issues came right back into our face. These were mostly wholesalers that were out of state but were licensed in the state, and when the investigation got close to them, they just gave up their license and walked away. They weren't a licensee, so they were able to get out of being disciplined that way. We think that the civil penalty of $1,000 was not really a deterrent for some of the larger corporations that we have as licensees. Also, most of the other agencies, health-related regulatory agencies in the state, have $5,000 as a maximum. I've only found one that has $1,000 besides our board. So essentially that's it.
Did you have a question? Yes.
Yes. How many civil penalties have you issued, and how much money did that bring in this past year? That'd be one question. And then the other question is, what is the amount of revenue that you think you would generate from this, and what would it be used for?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Montes Anderson. You have 89? It looks like in last year there were 89 civil penalties issued. Do you have the dollar figure? We don't have the dollar figure for that. We don't anticipate this being much of a revenue producer. We think this is more of a deterrent than an issue of producing revenue. The board issues civil penalties pretty much as a last resort. Limited really to deliberate violations or repetitive violations or particularly egregious violations that gets into the monetary penalties. If it's not one of those, the board issues letters of concern or reprimands. So I don't know how to anticipate how frequently the board would use that. This would allow them to, so they wouldn't necessarily be required to go to that right away.
So, just follow up.
Yeah.
So you're not aware of how many, how much money you've actually received from civil penalties in this past year. Is that information,
Senator,
that you could get?
I think we could get that.
I think that would be pertinent for us to know.
Okay, we can get that to you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Sorry, we don't have that today. We probably should have that.
Senator George.
I have three quick questions. Number one, is this a complaint-driven process?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, yes, it is. It's generally we have received some tips, not directly a complaint, but a tip that we would go investigate. But mostly, we're complaint-driven.
Inspections also.
Also, we do inspections of these drug outlets, and sometimes the inspection will produce a question that we need to follow up.
Okay. Thank you. Question number two. Thank you. I see that you're adding this assessment for the cost of disciplinary process against the person. I just witnessed a disciplinary action in which the individual has $10,000, probably in attorney fees at this time. I sat through the proceedings. There was no foundation in the accusation. The issue had been resolved before it got to the board, and yet this person's got this money. Would you entertain a bill that if, in fact, that person is found innocent, that is a false charge, that your commission, your board would reimburse for their cost?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Senator George, I mean, that as a concept is something I'm sure that we would look at. My understanding of this bill, though, is that it would only assess a fee for the disciplinary process. So if somebody was not found in violation and was not disciplined, that there wouldn't be an assessment of any cost.
And the third question is, how many of these, you have 89 civil penalties. How many of the accusations were found to be false or were dropped?
That would have been all of them.
These are the ones that were actually
right.
Issued. These, Mr. Chair,
that's
Senator, these were the ones that were actually issued. There are some that are issued and then eventually negotiated into a settlement that may have been a smaller sum or no money at all, but some sort of a remediation or quality assurance efforts.
Okay, thank you. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm, Gary, I'm assuming that most of the 89, or the vast majority, would never rise to this level anyway. But my question is, in the language you're adding, it says, may take other disciplinary action, including not limited to. What other sorts of disciplinary action would you be envisioning other than what's listed here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, the board has a range of discipline from reprimand, which the board thinks is the least disciplinary action, up to civil penalties, suspension of license, revocation of license, and revocation is the highest penalty that the board can have. There is nothing in our statute that actually states reprimand. And so we did have a case one time where the defense counsel argued that we couldn't reprimand his client because it doesn't say reprimand in our statute. But we had always thought that the board had the full range. I think that statement would clarify that. So whether okay. It was individually stated or not.
So this is more or less to codify what you're already doing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I think that's right.
Okay. Senator Bridger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious about, it's a civil penalty, but some pharmacists have associates or pharmacists in training that are working in the store. And if they were caught either filling a prescription for a pain medication that the doctor hadn't ordered or things like that, would that fall under criminal or would that be a civil matter?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, we deal with those if they're licensees of ours as a civil matter. We aren't a law enforcement agency. Our authority extends to the license that we provide to an individual. So if they were a licensee, it would be a civil matter with their license. If it was somebody who was not a licensee of ours, but they were in the pharmacy, they were in training, we would hold the pharmacist responsible for allowing that to happen. We don't have any legal enforcement authority over somebody that's not a licensee.
So the pharmacist would get...
Pharmacist or the pharmacy, who are both licensees, would get some sort of
penalty.
Yeah.
Follow-up, Mr.
Chair.
Yes. I'm curious. I don't believe you answered Senator Mons Anderson's question about, and what is the money used for when your fund that you collect from
Mr.
the
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, that money good just goes back into our bank account, the Board of Pharmacy's bank account, and will be added to the ending balance that's there if we have an ending balance after our budget is spent. We don't earmark that for anything in particular. It just becomes a piece of income that goes in there. And I apologize, but we will get that figure for you. I don't think it's very big, but we'll get that for you tomorrow.
Okay. That's a ways and means question, I guess, at some point. Well, okay, when the Ways and Means Subcommittee hears your board's budget, a lot of questions will be asked about, the excess amount that you have in your balance and whether or not it's too much or not enough and so on and so forth.
But they don't get any general fund.
You're right. Yeah. The question that I have, though, is give me some examples of a person rather than a licensee who is going to be penalized.
Mr. Chair, the easiest way to say that is somebody would be practicing pharmacy without a license.
Okay.
I mean, in a nutshell, there are various examples that you might see.
So
for
that's
that,
why the word person is listed along with licensee.
That's correct.
Are there other examples of person other than someone practicing without a license? maybe not.
Well, in our example, sorry, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and the pharmaceutical wholesalers that we investigated.
You mentioned that.
Some of them were not licensed in our state, but they were doing business.
Okay.
Illegal business in our
so
state.
They
would be a person.
Okay.
Well, not a licensee.
Okay. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you received a complaint that was a billing dispute, would you pursue beyond that against the pharmacy? Would you deal only with the billing dispute, or would you go into all their other practices? Because what I'm thinking about is the case that I described a minute ago was a single issue that became multiple, at least five. So technically, if you guys decide to pursue somebody by fishing a little bit further, then we could be looking at $25,000 in penalties. And if you think about it, a $5,000 penalty is still a pretty big threat. But can you go beyond the issue that was submitted as a complaint?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, very often we get a complaint about one issue, and when we get into the investigation, we discover other pieces of that. We go in with the investigation initially and investigate whatever we can find. Although our authority only extends to Chapter 689, the Pharmacy Practice Act, and so only violations of that practice act would be under our jurisdiction. There could be other issues that we might have to pass on to somebody. We don't have any authority other than our practice act.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, seeing none, we will close. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you?
Nothing, Gary, pretty much covered it. So.
Pardon me?
No, thank you, Chair. Gary pretty much covered it all.
Okay. Good. Okay, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 200 to the floor of the Senate with a deep pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 200 to the floor of the Senate with a deep pass recommendation.
Well, it's not a ways and means? Oh, no. You're right.
No. Discussion.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I will be a no vote. If this was $2,000, I might be acceptable. It might be acceptable, but this is an amazing jump in the amount of assessment. And I'm a little bit worried about what I've been discovering about operations of some of the boards. With that in mind, I will be a no vote.
Let me clarify, or have you clarify, what you mean by operations of some of the boards. You mean excessive fines or excessive reserves or what?
My thought is if you have a $1,000 fine, you might operate on the issue. If you have a $5,000 fine per event, per offense, that in fact it might be very valuable to go out and do what, as one person, a representative from the House said, a witch hunt, in which in fact they were attempting to achieve an amazing amount of money, and by the way, at the tremendous expense to the accused individual. So with that in mind, I think there's too much of an incentive to really pursue it if in fact the fine is too high.
Okay, let me further
okay.
get a sense of what you're saying. You're concerned that they may go after a single individual with excessive fines?
Well, yeah,
to have more than one fine?
Right. We had an answer that they would in fact, or they have in fact, with a complaint of, say, billing, mm-hmm. go way beyond that. I don't want a perverse incentive for them to go way out there in order to achieve $5,000 per violation. I just find that as an amazing leap,
okay.
and without any evidence that we have a problem. I mean, nobody's escaped, nobody made it out of here, nobody didn't own up for their practices. So with that,
okay.
that's where I am.
Okay, thank you. Okay. I guess my response to your concern, although I certainly respect your concern, is that the Ways and Means Budget Committee looks at the amount of money that is on hand. They also look at the types of complaint. I guess just having come from a Ways and Means Budget Committee, I'm and dealing with the Board of Medical Examiners and going into some of these very questions, I feel comfortable that there is oversight dealing with excessive fines and going after someone you know, that will show up in the analysis of the budget hearing. So I personally don't have a problem.
Mr. Chairman, I need to tell you, and I started to ask this question, that we asked to be present as the board acted on this individual. Basically, we were told that we could be there, but they had the authority to deny the elected representatives of that individual being present.
Okay.
That makes me very nervous that things are occurring behind closed doors that could literally be devastating for such, for a person's practice.
So you're talking about a specific case that you're
yes.
aware of.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, and Senator George and I have discussed that, but that was not in the Board of Pharmacy. And I've had a fairly long, as you have, Mr. Chair, history with the Board of Pharmacy. I don't think this is a money grab on their part, and I don't think it's going to change the way they conduct their business. But I think the fact is many of the other major boards in the field of medicine have increased their penalties quite simply to keep up with the times and to make it a penalty that is... that somebody will pay attention to, and I think it's appropriate. It's what we've done with the other major boards over the last couple sessions, and I would be incredibly surprised, Mr. Chair, if we saw any change in the way the Board of Pharmacy conducts their business.
Okay. Mr.
Chair, yes,
Senator Virgil. To just kind of go with this, and I think that sometimes in these bills, that's what is very confusing and causes some concern on the part of committee members, and it is that section that says the board may take other disciplinary action as the board in its discretion mm-hmm. finds proper. And I think that you know, when the bill goes forward, you're trusting, and I'm not saying that that's misplaced trust, I'm just saying you're trusting that the board can find discretion, in their discretion, that they would only use that discretion when it was absolutely necessary. So I think there's a trust factor there, which is somewhat vague and does leave a little bit of an open door that causes concern, and I think that's where Senator George is coming from.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond to that quite simply, because this is fairly standard language, because for us to put in statute all of the remedies a board, whatever the board is going to need to have available, is rather foolish, because times do change and you know, I think there is a point in time if you believe in the integrity of the process and the people who are serving, you have to believe that integrity is there. So this is relatively common language, and because for us to list in statute every action of remedy a specific board would take, we'd spend half a session each time rechecking that list and doing adds and takes and stuff like that. So I think this is relatively common language for this sort of application.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Yes, indeed.
very eloquent speech here about common language. I'm just, I'm not saying that I don't have some trust in the Board of Pharmacy. I do. However, I'm saying that I think that sometimes when language is broad, that it does cause concerns, and there's not really a reason to have broad language.
Mm-hmm.
This bill is a very, very simple bill. It increases from $1,000 to $5,000 for a civil penalty, and that's really all that needed to be in this bill. So that language was not necessary for the increase in the penalty. And I'd be happy if they want to respond to that, but I'm not going to belabor it and beat the horse to death. But that is language that did not need to be in the bill.
Okay, Senator Mona Sanderson, did you have anything to add?
Well. Having dealt with the Board of Nursing, this language is fairly standard, and there are situations that come up that it's not appropriate necessarily to make assessments of cost. I read this as if, well, there needs to be a diversion of an employee or of the owner or whoever, the pharmacist, to... a alcohol drug treatment or, you know, I'm not sure I'm reading it into that, but that there are other disciplinary actions that the board needs to be able to do besides just assess the fine. So that's how I read it.
I agree.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Would you entertain an amendment that says that to the prevailing party, attorney fees or the collection of appropriate assessments of cost would be appropriate? Let me make it clear. I have nothing against the pharmacy board. Never heard one complaint about you. Mm-hmm. But I've become a little bit aware of the fact that things that occur behind closed doors, even when the accused cannot invite a legislator in, makes me a little nervous about massive increases. So.
Mr. Chair, I'm questioning whether that would create a relating clause issue because this is relating to disciplinary authority. It's not relating to I think, Senator George, what you're talking about. This is
lines 28 and 29 of the bill.
Mm-hmm. But this is after finding the fact.
Well, that's what mine would do. Is that if in fact the person was found innocent, that we would reimburse them for their costs.
That's, I think, is a different issue. Well, you're talking about an amendment, but are we ready to move the bill?
Yeah.
Okay. Other comments? Okay. Seeing none, we will call the roll, please.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator George?
No.
Senator Monica Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morse?
Aye. Senate Bill 200, having received the constitutional majority, passes and will go to the floor of the Senate. And said no.
Yeah, you want me to carry it?
Just wanted to see if you were awake and paying attention.
It would be entertaining.
Senator Cruz will do double duty today. How's that?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good, very good. Okay, so we will skip a hop, skip, and a jump to Senate Bill 188, and we will come back to Senate Bill 35. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 188. You want to tell us what it's about?
Senate Bill 188 requires health professionals to complete minimum practice requirements in the time period immediately following completion of training requirements for execution of an agreement. It also adds benefits to the list of health professionals who may qualify.
Oh, goodness. Okay. Jane Myers, would you come up, please? Joel Young? Joe Young. Oh, Joe. Yes, if that's okay.
Okay
with me,
honey. Jane. I'm Jane Myers, representing the Oregon Dental Association, and providing some written comments from the president of the Oregon Dental Association. These are all in support of the bill. Dr. Gary Brooks, who's a member of the Oregon Rural Health Coordinating Council, and a copy of an email, you probably already have seen this, is from Todd Gifford, who's the president of the Dental Student Government at OHSU's School of Dentistry, all supporting the bill for the reason that it would help with the distribution of dentists, try to get, this is a pretty good incentive to get them into rural areas. And I think as Mr. Gifford points out, when the dental students finish their training, they have about a $200,000 bill for their training at the dental school. And then looking at moving into establishing a rural practice, He says you'd have to figure about another $300,000 for starting a clinic if you didn't have to buy land. So the costs of moving out to a rural area of the state are they're there, and this is an attractive way to try to get students, graduates, to consider a dental practice in a rural, especially a rural underserved area. The I'm told that the dental school is starting to do rural rotations for the dental students, which is also another way for them to get familiar with working in a rural clinic. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Jane, why would I get a phone call from a dentist in Roseburg wanting dentists to be added to this bill? See,
because
now this is what the bill is.
Oh, well, that's what the bill does. Oh, well, Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, I'm not sure what the answer to the question is. Probably,
I wasn't sure what the answer.
It probably is confusion.
Okay.
I think the intent was to try to get some of the members of the committee informed by their constituents that they did support the bill.
Ms. Chair, because I haven't called him back yet. I know him. He's a good dentist. And I'm looking at this bill, and I'm not quite sure what he's talking about, how we could add dentists to a bill that adds dentists.
I'm sure he just meant to support the bill.
Thank you, Jane. Mr. Young.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee. I'm Joel Young, and I'm here on behalf of Dr. Grant Higginson, who's the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning for State Public Health. And I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 188. I think this is a pretty good bill. It focuses on a key health workforce issue, as has just been indicated to you, and it does it through a loan repayment mechanism. And it helps to strengthen that mechanism as well. This is when you want to address issues of access and capacity, it's pretty critical that you have a whole tool bag, and this is one tool that you'd want to have in addition to some others. And I want to particularly address the addition of dentists. I mean, I think the whole program is a part of the whole tool bag for all of the workforce shortages, but dental is a particularly critical one. And it's particularly critical for implementing sustainable and effective oral health prevention programs in medically underserved areas. So it's not only the work the dentist does, but the work the dentist does is part of a whole system to ensure that children get preventative services. We know that there's an extreme shortage of dentists in rural areas. And again, this bill is targeted at that. And one of the issues that came up when the Rural Health Coordinating Council held a series of town meetings around the state was dental. And it repeatedly came up as something that they felt needed to be addressed in rural areas. The dental shortage is even more critical if you look at pediatric dentists. And that's one of the that's one of the important places where good oral health care and prevention can have the greatest impact. They become instrumental to helping make that happen. We've got about 79 licensed pediatric dentists in the state, and only 27 of them practice outside of the Portland metro area. Increasing incentives for dentists to practice in rural areas is going to increase the level of access for all Oregonians, and it's going to, again, make for a more solid preventive care program. Best practices approaches in oral health prevention, including the use of dental sealants, rely on the involvement of dentists. In Oregon, a dentist must screen a child before a dental hygienist can place dental sealants. So what we get for that kind of activity, and with the increase in the number of dentists, are less dental disease, fewer treatment costs, fewer emergency room visits, and ultimately lower medical costs for chronic conditions that are linked to oral disease. And so in summary, what I'd like to just really reemphasize again is this is part of a critical tool chest for dealing with Oregon's workforce shortages. That we've got a real shortage of dentists in rural areas, especially pediatricians, and we have an opportunity to have a greater impact on the lives of children if we can create incentives like this and get more dentists and more pediatricians into rural areas. I just want to, in closing, make a note. I handed out to you also something called State Experience with Dental Loan Repayment Programs. And this is some material put together by the National Conference of State Legislatures, who looked at all of the state loan repayment programs that include dental. and surveyed those states and then analyzed that information. So the bolded areas are the ones that I particularly want to draw your attention to, although I think all of their comments are interesting. They're again reiterating on a national level the shortage of dentists in rural areas and how critical it is, that need is to be responded to. When you look at the other side of it, the second page, one of the things that I want to draw your attention to is their comment that although state experience with loan repayment programs is relatively new and the programs still are operating on a small scale, the examples highlighted in this report suggest that loan repayment is cost-effective, is increasing the number of providers in underserved areas, and is enhancing access to oral health in those communities. So again, they looked at a number of programs across the nation to reach that conclusion. They also said that a strategy, meaning the loan repayment one, should be part of a series of other interventions. And those would be educational, practice reform, and finance of care. So I think this is absolutely critical that we move forward with this, but also to see it in the broader context of other things that need to be done over time. And then the final point I draw your attention to was their focus on the National Health Service Corps, which is a federal loan repayment program. And they were using that because it has a longer history going back to 1970. State loan repayment programs, including dental, really only go back 3, 4, 5 years for the most part. But they're saying that for the National Health Service Corps, at least 50% of the clinicians remain in service to be served after they fulfill their service obligations. So I think their point being that's a kind of indicator that we think we can look forward to in, within the state loan repayment program. Anyway, so that's the course of my comments, and I appreciate your the opportunity to speak with you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Bridger.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a process question, and please excuse me. This is probably Loan Repayment Programs 101, but explain to me how, if I'm training to be a dentist, I finish my training, and I owe all of this money, how does that debt get reduced? I understand a loan repayment that I would have to pay, but isn't this a part of reducing the amount of the loan?
Mr. Chair and Senator Verger, perhaps it would be best to hear from the Office of Rural Health. They might be able to enlighten the committee more on that topic. I'm probably not a good source to answer that question.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Scott, would you come up, please? Scott Ekblad from the Office of Rural Health. Suzanne Nye, Oregon Student Association. And Ree Sailors from the Governor's Office. Okay. Would you like to start by answering that question, Scott?
I'd be happy to. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health, which is located at Oregon Health and Science University. And the way the program works is that after 1 year of service in a qualifying community, the practitioner is cut a check that they then apply to their debt, to their loans. Does that answer your question?
Well, that partly. What kind of check? I owe thousands of dollars. What percentage of my loan is going to be with that check?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, in answer to your question, the maximum award that can be given through this program is of $100,000. So in the case of physicians and pharmacists, that's over a five-year period of time at 20% per year. So that would be 20% of $100,000, $20,000 check. They must practice a minimum of 3 years, and so it's possible that they could go through and fulfill their obligation and only get 60% or $60,000 in loan repayment award. If they worked all 5 years, they could get a maximum of $100,000.
Okay. A follow-up, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. And where does the money come from? Where, what fund does it come out of that pays me to reduce my loan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, there is a separate Rural Health Services Fund that is part of Oregon Student Assistance Commission.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. What is the average debt? Maybe someone said it. And then what is the mean? I mean, you start low, and what's the highest?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, I think that we've probably seen quite the range in that some people have to borrow less than others. I just heard Jane from the Dental Association say that dentists come out with approximately $200,000 worth of debt. I've heard the figure quoted for physicians of about $150,000, but $200,000 is not at all uncommon, $200,000. This program also covers nurse practitioners and physician assistants whose debt could also be $100,000 or more, but usually substantially less. I think what we see through the loan repayment award process is probably more like 35 or 40? About 40.
Okay.
All right.
Go ahead.
I did have some prepared testimony today. Just to start with a little bit of background, the Oregon Rural Health Services Loan Repayment Program was created in 1989 and was funded at a level of $400,000 per biennium, and that is the level, still the level of funding today. As I mentioned, it covers physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and during the last legislative session, pharmacists were added to the program without an increase in funding. The program has had an impact, and Suzanne Ney is here today with statistics available should you be curious as to what the program's accomplished so far. But I personally feel that with the changes suggested in Senate Bill 188, it could really be a very powerful tool to address the difficulties in recruiting rural practitioners. I'm going to talk a little bit about, and I won't cover everything that's in my printed testimony, but I'll talk a little bit about the need for a state loan repayment program. During the last 6 months of 2005, the Office of Rural Health and our advisory body, the Rural Health Coordinating Council, conducted town hall meetings in seven different communities around the state. And as was mentioned earlier, in every single community, recruitment issues came up as a very high priority. Of course, that wasn't any surprise to us, but it is repeated from one community to another. We also have a rural dentist that serves on our advisory body, the Rural Health Coordinating Council. He has on several different occasions brought to us statistics that show that our state's dentists, and particularly rural dentists, are aging, that the only school of dentistry in the state is not producing enough to cover the anticipated retirements. We have to remember that we're the only school of dentistry in the region and are surrounded by states that do not have a school of dentistry, so we're just naturally going to be an exporter of dentists. And also just simply recommending that incentive programs such as loan repayment are needed in the state. Probably the most startling evidence of the need for incentives is the distribution of physicians we currently have in the state as a whole. And if you look at pages 3 and 4 of my testimony, it shows the ratio of population to physicians. And as you can see, there's one physician per 800 people in frontier areas, about the same in rural areas of the state, whereas in urban there is one physician for every 330 people. So we're really talking about a maldistribution. The next page of my testimony shows it in terms of percentages, whereas frontier parts of our state have 1.3% of our population, 2.6% of our population, only 1.3% of the physicians. Rural areas, 31.4% of our population, but 16.6% of the physicians, and in urban that is reversed, whereas 66% of the population lives in the urban communities in our state. They have 82% of the physicians. So it's really a maldistribution problem.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could I ask Scott please define rural for me?
Sure.
On this program?
Sure. The eligibility criteria for this program is communities in the state that are less than 30,000 and at least 10 miles from the center of a community that's 30,000 or more.
So at this point, Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
So at this point, as with the other bill we did on the tax credit, if we're going to make accommodation, for example, for Grants Pass, we would need to make an adjustment. Because Grants Pass currently would no longer qualify.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cruz, that's true. Grants Pass has exceeded 30,000. There are about 30,930 people now.
Mr. Chair, and I bring up Grants Pass if I can do a follow-up quite simply because, especially if we do not get the safety net reauthorized, a lot of counties will be hurt really bad, but Josephine County will be absolutely devastated.
Mr. Chair, yes. There's another thing that I was thinking about. For instance, Coos Bay and North Bend together, probably a total of about 30,000. They'd be close. And they run together, literally. So I don't know if you consider that one population center, or do you consider Coos Bay with 16,000 rural, because its population is 16, but yet it has an encompassing 30,000 people. So the definition is important to me, because I think that the effectiveness of the program depends a lot on how you define rural. And I think after we had the last bill, I realized how complicated it is to come up with something that really fits rural, because you can leave Portland, and I agree with that. You don't have to drive far before you're in the country and farmland and small populations. But I do think that it's important for the effectiveness of the program.
Vice Chair Cruz and Senator Verger, we would consider Coos Bay and North Bend both to be rural communities because we look at the zip codes that are part of the city limits.
Right.
And we break down the population into zip code level.
Right.
Shoot, I didn't get past any bills while you were gone.
And for good reason.
I can also offer
good,
some...
I'm sorry.
Oh.
On page 2, lines 19, 20 through 21, and then 25 through 27, so you have parts of the state that actually fund these programs for the people who go to that part of the state. Is that correct?
Chair Morissette, the statute currently allows the Office of Rural Health to raise matching funds for this program. But the statutory language that exists, the way it's currently implemented, really doesn't allow the Student Assistance Commission to take that into consideration when making awards. So at this point, we have not raised any matching funds. The changes proposed in this bill would enable us not only to raise matching funds, but allow the Student Assistance Commission to dedicate loan repayment to the community that donated the funds, which, of course, would be following the intent, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, that is the purpose of that section.
Okay. Line 25, a qualifying practice site shall submit an application to the Office of Rural Health to participate in the program. The office shall make a list of qualifying practice sites available to prospective physicians and so on. So, what's the connection between the money received to pay off a loan and the site that the student practices at and the contribution? Do I understand it right that the money comes from that particular site?
Mr. Chair, not currently. It could, however, should this bill pass. And
excuse me, that's what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
If this bill passes, then that's the idea.
Yes, this bill does two things that would allow that to happen. One, it would allow the Student Assistance Commission to give priority to a community who donates money, but it also gives preference to candidates who have already matched with the community, and that's one of the problems that we're trying to address with this bill, is that at this point, the relationship or the award is really only between the candidate and the Student Assistance Commission. There's not a tie to a community. They're given a list of possible communities, but the community then can't turn around and use that as a carrot when they're recruiting, because once the award is made, the practitioner can literally move every 6 months and travel around the state as long as they're in a qualifying community.
Okay, well, that's what I'm getting at. That is what this bill will do.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
And I feel like we're all fairly knowledgeable about the fact that it's very difficult to recruit, and I won't belabor that point. I think instead I'll just point out that some of the graphs in your testimony show that not only is our country really not producing enough physicians to make up for retirements of the current workforce, but certainly not enough to meet the demands of an aging population as the baby boomers start to require more medical visits. Also want to point out that, you know, it's sort of a wax and wane situation as to whether or not a medical student will end up choosing a primary care specialty for their residency training. And, of course, and we're in a period right now where that is declining again, where fewer and fewer medical students are choosing a medical primary care specialty. And, of course, that's exactly what's needed in a rural community. So we're looking at a shrinking pool of candidates. And I'll move on to the specific problems that I see currently with this program and how I think that this bill will address them. And so on the second to the last page of my testimony, problem one, and we've addressed this a bit, but the loan repayment awards are currently given directly to the candidates, and they're not tied to a specific site whatsoever. And therefore, the sites cannot use this program as a recruitment tool. And at this point, nearly all the candidates who apply for loan repayment do so without having a connection to any particular practice site. They are given a list of all the qualifying communities, but the fact of the matter is you have to talk to someone to find out that there's probably no clinic in many of these communities. There's no opportunity to practice in any of these communities unless you want to go and invest all the startup costs it would take to start a new business, in a sense. So what this bill would do is require that sites apply beforehand and become qualified, you know, be able to confirm that they do actually have a job opening, that there is an entity that will pay a salary or guarantee a salary, sponsorship of some kind, sponsorship by a community, so that it is a real opportunity that a candidate could actually interview for and make a knowledgeable decision about, preferably prior to actually being awarded loan repayment. Problem number two, the statute's currently worded so that a loan repayment recipient is able to postpone working in a qualifying area for 2 or even 3 years, and many actually eventually decline the award. And in the meantime, these funds are encumbered. In other words, if we've committed them to a particular candidate, we can't then turn around and award it to someone else while this prior candidate is making up their mind. And so the solution to this problem is that this would require loan repayment recipients to fulfill their minimum obligated service at the beginning of the full service period. So for physicians, they have a period of 5 years. They have to work a minimum of 3, but it can be the last 3 of the 5 at this point. This would require that they serve for the first 3 years instead. Problem number three, while the current statute allows the Office of Rural Health to raise matching funds for the program, it's unclear whether the Student Assistance Commission can prioritize awards based on the source of those matching funds. Further, there's no requirement that a candidate practice in the site that donated the funds. So this would clean that up a bit and specifically states that the Student Assistance Commission, number one, can give priority to a candidate who already has an employment agreement or a memorandum of understanding with a practice site, and number two, can give preference to communities with a matching candidate that has dedicated some matching funds to the program. And finally, problem number four, the program as it stands cannot be used to recruit dentists who are also greatly needed in Oregon communities, and Senate Bill 188 would add dentists to the list of eligible professions. And in summary, I just really think that with all the tools that we have available, and Mr. Young is absolutely correct that there's no one solution to the maldistribution of physicians and the difficulty in recruiting for rural areas, this is one tool that could be extremely powerful. It's a daunting thought to come out of your training, having spent so many years in school and then residency training and then to really have a mortgage without a house, $150,000 or $200,000, to then consider whether or not to practice in an urban area where you have a guaranteed salary and a lot of the amenities that go along with practicing in a big urban group versus going to a rural community where you will certainly work longer hours for less money, have a higher percentage of Medicaid patients and Medicare patients, and therefore your compensation just potentially is not going to be as great. If we were at least able to tell some of these folks that we'll pay off your student loans or at least a great portion of them, I think that that would make the difference. So thank you very much for the opportunity. I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Thanks, Scott.
Senators, my name is Suzanne Ney. That's Ney with an N, as in Nancy. I am the executive assistant to the director and public program manager at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission in Eugene. I've been managing this program for about 9 years. The statistical information that I provided to you is a view of the program overall since its inception and the first year that it actually paid out, which was 1994. And then the bottom portion of the statistical information shows the current counties and the practitioners that are in those counties today. There's a little bit of a discrepancy between the nurse practitioners. It says participants currently active and receiving repayment are 11, and the information at the bottom shows 5. We just recently had 6 nurse practitioners receive their 4th and final payment, and so they will no longer be paid in this program. The Oregon Student Assistance Commission supports this bill, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide this statistical information, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
How many have been in the program and have met all obligations are still located where they work?
I don't have the exact statistical information, but it's about 60% are still working in the communities where they receive the loan repayment.
Okay, Ms. Chair, and I guess I'm sure you have the information. I would be interested in breaking MDs out from NPs and PAs because my sense is the NPs and PAs are more inclined to stay. The MDs might be more inclined to move. But I may be wrong. But I'm supportive of the program. I'm supportive of the bill. I just would like to have kind of a tracking of it a little bit. So.
Okay. Thank you. Yes. Senator Bridger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want you to explain a little bit about the chronology to me. It doesn't follow in what I'm thinking. The program started in 1989, but you said the first payout was 1994.
Yes.
And, of course, that's been 12 years. And just looking at the problems that have been listed here, it looks to me like there's been a certain amount of abuse of the program.
Senator Berger, Chair Morissette, I'm not sure I understand.
Well, the program, the way that it is, apparently, is rather loose. In other words, I can wait 3 years to keep the funds encumbered. I don't have to say where I don't have. I can choose my site wherever I want to go. You know, you don't look a gift horse in the mouth. If somebody's going to give you a lot of money, there are a lot of strings attached to that, and that's okay. And so the way it is, it looks to me like the person that is expecting the loan repayment has had the best of the two. In the partnership, they've been able to call the shot, so to speak, and so and that's been for 12 years. So, I guess I'm kind of curious why it's taken so long to bring a bill that tightens that up. I like this bill. I think you're getting there. You're improving, but you've been thinking about it a long time.
Senator Virgin, Chair Morissette, let me give you a brief overview of how the program currently works, and then maybe you can relate how this new bill, Senate Bill 188, will tie up some of the loose ends. Currently, each practitioner applies to the program as an individual, not tied to a site. And if they are chosen for repayment, and this is on by the selection committee, which is made up of a doctor, a physician, a nurse practitioner, a physician assistant, and now a pharmacist, and a representative from the Office of Rural Health. These are the panel members who read the applications, score the applications, and make the selections. We then put the applicants in ranked order, you know, 1 through 13. We're able to award about 5 or 6 practitioners each year. When they are awarded, they're notified that they've been chosen to participate in the program, and we send out an agreement that says they have 2 years from the time they sign the agreement to find qualifying employment if they're not already in a qualifying site. If they're already in a qualifying site, the clock starts ticking on their first year of service. Once they've completed their first year of service, they receive their 20% or their 25%, depending on the practitioner. And for a maximum of the 3 year, or for a minimum of 3 years for a physician or a pharmacist, and a minimum of 2 years for a nurse practitioner or physician assistant, and up to 5 years for a physician to receive 20%. At the end of 5 years, it would be 100%. And maximum of 4 years for a nurse practitioner and a physician assistant. So, really the only lag that they have, which this bill will tighten up, is that 2 year flex period, giving them time to find qualifying employment. If they haven't found qualifying employment at the end of that 2 year mark, their agreement is considered null and void, and the money that was set aside, earmarked for them, is put back into the pot where it can draw interest and make future awards. So not only are we able to utilize the biennial appropriation of about $410,000, we also use money that was encumbered and returned and the interest that it accrues. So.
And the interest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the program's a good program. There's no doubt of that. And it's what you've told me so far, so good. But I'm glad that you're tightening up a little bit. I think people need to be accountable and appreciative and not take advantage of. And I'm not talking about where they're going to go. Now, I'd like to see it go a little further because I see these struggling communities like in my district that are very small towns. I go from Coos Bay to Lincoln City on the coast. And so all my communities are smaller communities. And I see the struggles that they go through. And if I had my way, I could say, well, we need one here and put one here and one here, and that isn't the way it works. But I do think this is a vast improvement into the program.
Yes, ma'am. Okay.
Thank you. Reese?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Reese Saylors. I'm with the Office of the Governor. And I just wanted to, I think you've gotten all the information, and through the Q&A that's been here, I think it's been very constructive. This is a priority to Governor Kulongoski. It's part of his continuing interest in providing access, to people throughout the state, and, the opportunity to get people into rural practice. These types of programs are some of the more effective programs in doing that. I, too, kind of like what's being done with this bill in terms of tightening it, and I think it's also creates the opportunity for even more partnerships with local communities. The fact that you can now potentially tie a site with a local community gives them a sense of they're going to get something, which I think may have the opportunity to increase the donations that might come to this fund as well, because I think communities will be able to see a return on their investment, so to speak, and know that they've got a healthcare professional coming into their area. The other thing is that you'll find in your colleagues in Ways and Means that the governor has increased the budget for this. The current stream of applicants is somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 40, and we only have the capacity to give out maybe 7 to 10 awards to those 30 or 40 applicants. Obviously, the need is greater than the supply of dollars, and so that is also an investment that's been made into the governor's recommended budget. Other than that, I think you've pretty much gotten the answers you want. We want to thank you for your consideration of this, and I think it will serve rural Oregon very, very well if we can make these improvements. Okay.
Questions? This is a good bill, Mr. Chair. Let's pass it.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing.
Thank you.
And open the work.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 188 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation, with an enthusiastic due pass recommendation.
An enthusiastic due pass recommendation. Comments? Okay. Seeing none. Call the roll, please.
Senator George?
Okay.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 188 passes and will go to the floor, and I will carry it. Thank you. Okay. We're going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 35. The strategy was that we would do the easy bills first and leave lots of time for discussion, but that didn't work out too well because we spent a lot of time on the last bill, which was good. It was good discussion. I'm not sure how far we're going to get with this. Robert, okay, we opened the public hearing, and would you describe the bill, please?
Senate Bill 35 authorizes optometrists to institute treatment with anti-glaucoma medication without prior consultation with an ophthalmologist or other doctor of medicine or osteopathy.
Okay. Robert Manns, yes, would you come up, please? Wayne Schumacher, yes. Okay, Wayne, do you want to lead off here,
I will,
seeing
sir,
how
thank
you're
you.
The veteran?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Wayne Schumacher. I'm the executive director of the Optometric Physicians Association, and with me this afternoon is our current president, Dr. Robert Manns, who is in private practice in Florence. And I'll let him kind of lead off with kind of the situation here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do live in Florence, and I've been there since 1994, and I'm here today to encourage your support for Senate Bill 35. I have been treating patients with glaucoma since 1994, as optometric physicians had the scope of practice changed in 1991, allowing us to prescribe topical medications. My optometric education prepared me for the diagnosis and treatment of patients with glaucoma, even as a new practitioner. When optometric physicians began treating patients with glaucoma, they did so using the same technology and medications available to any physician. The main medications used at that time had been around since about 1978 and were proven to be very effective at reducing vision loss in patients diagnosed with glaucoma. These drugs were very effective, but had the potential to have some serious side effects in a select few patients. The concern over these side effects resulted in the language where a consult between an optometric physician and an MD or a DO was needed before starting treatment for a patient with glaucoma. In 1996, the evolution of some new medications altered the treatment strategy for the majority of these patients. These new medications are more effective and do not cause the same side effects as the medications used prior to their introduction. The safety and effectiveness of these new drugs have made them the first choice of treatment for most glaucoma patients. In 2001, Senate Bill 45 was passed, allowing optometric physicians to prescribe oral pharmaceuticals. This was done in recognition of our advanced training and need to better serve patients as primary eye care providers. Continuing education and training ensures that optometric physicians will stay abreast of the latest methods for treating and managing glaucoma. As primary eye care providers, we understand our role to serve the patient and treat them for their conditions or, when necessary, consult with a specialist. This is evident in the fact that there has not been one complaint or problem case registered with the Oregon Board of Optometry regarding our use of these medications. The current requirement for an initial consult with an MD or DO is unnecessary. It is not cost-effective or efficient, nor does it improve my ability to treat the patient. I urge you to support Senate Bill 35 and repeal ORS 683.720. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Schumacher.
Yes. Members of the committee, as a follow-up to Dr. Mann's, the purpose of this is language that's been languishing around for over 14 years. Optometry has been treating glaucoma for over 14-plus years with absolutely no problems, as he has said. The executive director of the Board of Pharmacy is actually in the audience today, Dr. David Plunkett, and he is here ready to testify to the fact that there have been absolutely no problems. There have been no complaints. Senator Alan Bates was consulted in the language of this. He agreed with the fact that the language was of actually no use, and the fact that it is actually standard practice now to coordinate any kind of a medication introduction with the patient's primary care physician to make sure there's no interaction problems with drugs. So that's automatically a standard practice nowadays. We met with the Academy of Ophthalmology in June to bring them this language and to ask them for any particular comments or suggestions, and we heard none, and there hadn't been any until just recently. Now we understand that there's suggested language that, in fact, most of it is already in statute and, frankly, would serve nothing but to confuse the issue at this particular point. And sets up standards that are far more restrictive than have been in existence for the last 14 years. Consequently, we would, again, like to suggest that you support this bill and move it as it is, in fact, I think, good language and would improve the current statute. Any questions?
Question? Okay. Gary?
Mr. Chair.
There you are.
Clarification, yes, in the bill, line 10, the section, it's 2, it's probably a subsection, on the second page. Optometrists utilizing pharmaceutical agents shall be held to the same standards of liability as persons licensed as physicians to practice medicine and surgery by the Board of Medical Examiners for the State of Oregon under ORS Chapter 677. My understanding is that the ophthalmologists are concerned not with the initial treatment of glaucoma, not by the optometrist treating it, but at what point does the optometrist turn the glaucoma patient over to them that would require surgery. Does this language in any way address that?
The language in proposed bill from ophthalmology, is that what you're asking?
The one that I just read, the section that I just read.
Basically the education and the treatment of glaucoma patients is monitored, you know, through several different tests. And I would not, every physician who is trained to treat glaucoma has the ability to become aware when treatment strategy is no longer working and the referral to a specialist is needed. So that's kind of how it's... Does that answer your question?
It does. It does.
It's commonly being done right now.
I follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I guess my question would be, do you know what the concern is? In other words, the concern expressed to me is that they want to be sure that at some point you're referring the glaucoma patient. It's not the contact initially or prior to treatment that doesn't worry them, but that at some point, the point at which you said they would be turned over to a specialist. I don't know why that wouldn't just naturally occur, so I guess maybe I need somebody to explain to me why that wouldn't naturally
occur. That is correct. I mean, that's how we've done it since we've gained these privileges, and it you know, there are tests that are involved, and that's exactly what happens to this day, that if a patient is at a point where we cannot control them and other methods of treatment are needed, possibly even surgery, then a glaucoma specialist is referred to.
Chair Morissette, Senator Ruger, if I might add too, a general ophthalmologist and an optometrist would refer to a glaucoma specialist who is a specialist ophthalmologist at about the same point. So the issue is at what point is that? And the suggested language that ophthalmology is coming in with actually is incorrect. It wouldn't be a point where they would properly be referred. That's not a standard by which you would hold them to. Dr. Mance could probably explain it better than I as far as the test specific, but in tracking glaucoma, it's not a simple matter. So it's a matter of professional determination. At what point do you turn them over to a glaucoma specialist? It's the exact same thing that an general ophthalmologist would do. They wouldn't treat them beyond a certain point. So optometry is doing the same thing that ophthalmology is doing. So that might answer your question a little better.
So you're saying that the ophthalmologists in general do not treat the glaucoma patient for serious conditions, that they turn them over to a glaucoma specialist and not an not just an ophthalmologist. Someone beyond the general training of an ophthalmologist.
Chair Morissette, in fact, with how it has been in Florence, that is the case. When we have a patient, I mean, we will consult with our local ophthalmologist, and if it comes to the same conclusion that we have with regards to what we're doing, then they actually refer them on to a specialist, and they have one of my employees, for that matter, is a prime example to where the glaucoma has been difficult to be managed, and rather than them looking at her, having somebody from Portland take a look at her.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I have one other question. Have you seen the language that the ophthalmologists are bringing?
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, absolutely have. And again, it's obvious that at least two of the examples that are in that particular language are already in statute, so that's immaterial. And in addition to that, we were just given that, so we studied that those procedures or those specifics, and frankly, we don't see that it provides any patient protection at all. It just, I think, more serves to confuse the issue than anything else.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Nan Heim and Bob Kimbold. Dr. Bob Kimbold.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. Our members are 165 ophthalmologists in active practice throughout the state. They have 4 years of medical school plus at least 3 years of specialty training after medical school. With me today is Bob Kimbold, who's been in active practice here in Salem for the last 15 years, and he is past president and legislative chair of the academy. Mr. Schumacher is right. He invited us to meet with them, and we appreciated that courtesy very much, and it led us to lengthy discussions among our members about what would be best in terms of patient care. What is the point at which there should be an ophthalmologist involvement in treating glaucoma? And we do have our own bill that just came back from Legislative Council. I'm sorry that it wasn't here sooner. It hasn't yet been dropped. I just got it Thursday afternoon. And Dr. Tybalt will explain our rationale in coming up with this bill. I should mention that our bill also deletes the provision for prior consultation. But we support that as long as there is substitute language with something that makes more sense from the standpoint of patient care. And Dr. Tybalt will explain that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Tybalt. I'm a medical doctor and ophthalmologist here in Salem. I was hoping to give a brief summary of glaucoma and its care, and then hopefully explain our position with this bill, with both of these bills. Glaucoma is an eye disease in which the optic nerve, the main cable between the eye and the brain, is damaged, and with that damage comes loss of vision. There are 1.4 million nerve fibers in each optic nerve at the beginning of life, and if we lose any of those nerve fibers, we can lose vision. The most common variety of glaucoma is one in which the pressure in the eye is too high for the state of the optic nerve, and some of the optic nerve fibers die. If enough of the optic nerve fibers die, vision is lost. There are many varieties of glaucoma. The most common, as I said, is associated with high eye pressure. Nonetheless, the only way we have to treat glaucoma is to reduce the pressure in the eye. There are many ways to do that, ranging from eye drops to oral medications to laser to surgery done on the eye in the operating room. In America, the sequence of treatment begins with diagnosis of glaucoma or its related condition, ocular hypertension. Ocular hypertension is a condition in which the eye pressure is elevated, but there is no damage to the optic nerve. Glaucoma per se is reserved for the condition in which the optic nerve is damaged and there has been vision lost. When appropriate diagnostic a variety of diagnostic tests are performed and a clinical examination is performed by an expert examiner, then one can make a diagnosis that leads to treatment. So everything starts with the diagnosis. If a case of ocular hypertension in which the patient's best interest is served by lowering eye pressure, or certainly if glaucoma is diagnosed, then treatment is initiated. As I say, in America, we start with eye drops. That's the rationale that we use because it's a non-surgical intervention, and the medicines are very effective. But it is only one step in the treatment sequence of glaucoma. For example, in England, the primary treatment is surgery first. It is generally agreed in this country that the reason that the British system has evolved to do that first is to save money. Because if you operate on someone, even though the initial expense is higher, the long over the lifespan of an individual patient, you are likely to save money over the use of medicines. So there's nothing cast in stone that there's only one treatment available for glaucoma or only a couple. There's a wide spectrum of treatment that should be applied to each individual's care because each case is unique. Nonetheless, in the vast majority of cases, you start with eye drops, and the goal is to select a target pressure below which you believe the person will never lose vision. So if you see a patient and you diagnose glaucoma, then it's your job to determine what a target pressure would be, and you do whatever it takes to keep that pressure below that target pressure because that's where you think they will lose vision if you don't. So you have to be able and willing to use every means available to control the pressure and achieve that target. Sometimes, and in fact, now that we do have good medicines, the majority of times it can be achieved with eye drops. But when that is not the case, you have to be prepared to move down the sequence of treatment options. And that the last one, the way the standard of care in America dictates, is surgery. Now, I would certainly take issue with any comment that said that a general ophthalmologist does not treat glaucoma with surgical techniques. Every ophthalmology resident diagnoses and treats glaucoma throughout all the years of training, and this care that is provided as a resident is done under the supervision of practicing physicians. And we do laser techniques when they are indicated. We do surgical techniques in the operating room when they are indicated. And yes, for very complicated cases, I certainly refer a lot of patients to glaucoma specialists in Portland, or glaucoma specialists sometimes go to different areas in the state to provide their subspecialty care. But a general ophthalmologist is quite well versed with all treatments of glaucoma, and for example, I do laser treatments for glaucoma, I do surgical treatments for glaucoma, and so I would certainly take issue to any statement that said it, anything to the contrary. But the most important part of it is making a diagnosis and then applying an appropriate treatment for that diagnosis. And there's a spectrum of treatments that has to be pursued to achieve a target pressure, and that's the name of the game in glaucoma.
Yes, Senator George.
Doctor, do you know of any optometric physician who has not, when they saw that person was getting relief in the pressure, allowed that to go to the point of blindness? Wouldn't the liability on that be just unbelievably costly in addition to loss of eyesight for the patient?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, if you're in practice for a long time, you see lots of things. No one is perfect, and optometrists make mistakes, ophthalmologists make mistakes. I've certainly seen cases in which individuals with full-blown glaucoma have presented to me and who have been under the care of optometrists, and once you have lost vision with glaucoma, it is not restored. So, you know, but certainly I've seen such cases. But it's more what treatments can be applied, when they should be applied, and what the exact nature of the disease is. And the when is all important with this.
Can I do a follow-up?
Yes.
With your amendments, you're going to describe conditions worsen. Is there any liability for the optometrist if someone determines that you should have moved before the condition worsened to this level? Or how will that be determined? Is there specific language that will describe a pressure difference or something like that? How will that be done?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, we have included quite specific language in our bill describing an appropriate point for referral of glaucoma patients from optometrists to ophthalmologists. And this is pretty specific. I don't think it would confuse the issue. In fact, I believe it would clarify the issue, because when patients reach the point that we have described in our bill, there is a black and white mandate for referral to an ophthalmologist, because no further treatment other than what can be provided by an ophthalmologist is available, not to any practitioner. So I think this bill clarifies, our bill clarifies the question and unmuddies the water, because glaucoma can be murky stuff. There are people in 2007 under the care of world-class glaucoma specialists who are still losing vision and going blind. Glaucoma is an insidious disease. There is real blindness caused in this country by glaucoma still, and in certain subpopulations like African Americans and Hispanics, the incidence is higher because their utilization of the healthcare system is lower. Their blindness rates are even higher. So, yes.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Doctor. What is temporal arteritis?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Verger, temporal arteritis is an uncommon medical condition. It's a systemic disease, most commonly seen in patients who are in their seventh and eighth decades of life, in which there is an inflammation in the blood vessels that supply vital parts of the body, including the optic nerve. The blood supply is deprived to that organ by the inflammation in the blood vessel, and there's loss of vision, as well as a lot of other systemic symptoms. The endpoint of an optic nerve appearance, whether it's been damaged by glaucoma or temporal arteritis or other, say, a brain tumor that compresses the optic nerve, the end appearance can be very similar in that optic nerves turn pale and lose their structure when they are assaulted by these various disease conditions. So the appearance can vary, or the appearance can be the same in spite of the fact that the disease process can vary.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have come to a crossroads. We have a possible public hearing scheduled. Possible work session scheduled. What is the pleasure of the group?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would love to see the optometrist and ophthalmologist see if maybe the proposed amendment to the optometrist bill maybe could be worked out. I don't know if that's possible, but it sure would be nice if they could at least get together and whatever bill they were proposing, maybe look at wording and see what would work.
Senator Berger?
Well, I believe that the bill that the ophthalmologists are going to bring is the same as 35, but with an amendment. And so not seeing the language, I would not know. I would hope that we could wait and at least see the language, or as Senator Mons Anderson has suggested, that perhaps they could work something out, at least in the amendment. That would be agreeable. If that's the only change that they want to make, that would be really good.
Mr. Chair, obviously Nan said the bill came out of LC, so we can assume it would be first read probably next Monday at this point. You've got the draft, but we don't have it. So, I hate to do one bill and then work on another bill that's similar but different. So I would, whether they can work it out or not, I would at least like to have the committee have both bills so we can look at it and see what we think about them as well. So I would suggest that we wait until first reading, which will probably be next week, and then see what we have in our hands at that point.
You have to articulate that. The thumb is not.
I do. Thumbs are not good.
Well, they're good for some things. Like whole.
Well, I was agreeing, if I understood them correctly from the ophthalmologist, that they're willing to take out 683-270. Okay. It didn't specify what, in fact, would be a worsening condition. I think we have a reasonable compromise headed here, so I'd like to wait until we see the bill.
Okay. So we will close the public hearing and adjourn.